thought for the first week of the year. I want to try to speak to earlier today when I was thinking about it. I was like, I just want to say what the whole path is. That was the term that gave me the whole path. Like you're just walking off the street and you're like, I'm interested, I'm kind of a mess, I want to grow. And there's something that starts there with that little, like, I'm interested, I want to grow into myself, to know myself more deeply. And it goes all the way to, it describes in the texts when you become fully enlightened, you say something like, this is the ancient phrase, done is what had to be done. There is now no more coming to any state of being. Full liberation. I did everything that needs to be done. It's over. So, you know, the path from like ordinary confusion, stumbling in the door with some kind of something told you to come tonight, all the way to you've become a fully liberated being. I want to tell you that path. Right. Haha. But it's actually... the inspiration for wanting to tell it was, besides it being the first week of the year, and it seemed auspicious to try to do so, that there's a way that the path is complex only because we as beings are complex in our psyches, our personalities, all of our... the ways that we get caught are many. But if we really read and think about it and think about what these instructions point to over and over, the progress, the sequence, is actually fairly direct. There's a verse that is beloved from the Dhammapada, the sayings of the Buddha, that that translates like this. Don't do things that cause harm. Do things that are skillful. Purify your mind. That's the path of the Buddhas. So that's the ancient summation of the whole path. Don't do things that hurt beings, yourself, others, etc. Don't do wrong, essentially. Do right, right? Do that which is skillful, that which brings about well-being. So those two are a pair. Don't do the wrong, do the right. And then purify the mind, which stands out as that's the yogic instruction now. And then the fourth line just finishes off the verse. This is the teachings of the Buddha. Here's how you chant it. Sabbapapasakaranam Kusala supa sampada sachita pariyo dapanam etang buddhana sasanam. Something like that. I've done it really well. So let's look at each of these steps then. The first one, don't do that which causes harm, is the foundation of the whole thing. So it's a sequence. And the foundation, as we talk about often in here, is ethical practice. We chant it whenever we do the precepts. And ethical practice in the early Buddhist system is thought of in the negative. It's thought of as refraining from doing these things that cause harm. So the five precepts that lay people are encouraged to practice with are the guideline to not take life, to not steal or take that which isn't offered, to not misuse sexuality, to not lie or misuse speech, and to not misuse intoxicants. And some modern teachers like to spin them into the positive, and I do that as well. Like when we chant them, we say, I undertake the training to protect life, rather than undertake the training to not kill, which would be the more literal or traditional version. But But it also makes sense that they are, as the foundation of the path, spoken of in the negative. Because running through the whole sequence, don't do that which causes harm, do that which is skillful, purify the mind, is this thread of renunciation, which we talked about last week in some detail, letting go in how it shows up in the meditation practice. At the heart of the Buddha's teaching is the recognition that we are trapped or bound or in pain on a kind of existential level, not because life itself is intrinsically tormenting, but because a quality that is deep in our beings, the quality of grasping or wanting things to be different than they are, fearing experience, holding on to things, being confused about our relationship to things, that quality of grasping causes all of the torment and anxiety and stress that we experience. Without that quality of grasping, pain would just be pain, and pleasure would just be pleasure, and we would neither get freaked out by the one or freaked out by the other in a different way. We would be like, the Buddha said, you know, I live in the forest completely at peace with my mind like a wild deer. There's some way that liberation in this system sounds a lot like dissolving into the ecosystem or becoming again part of nature, less separate from the natural flow of things. And so then we start off, but with this basic practice of renunciation, don't do things that cause harm. And not doing those is a way to begin to unbind grasping, right? Why would I kill something other than either, why would I kill something intentionally, let's say, and that there is that designation, like the Buddhist system doesn't worry about you accidentally stepping on an ant in the way that the Jain system, for instance, did worry about that. The Buddhist system didn't worry about that. The Buddha said karma, or the way that you receive the results of your actions, hinges on intention. So refraining from killing means refraining from intentionally killing. Why would you intentionally kill something except out of fear or anger, you know, including self-protection? But the overriding thread of the ethical precept is that I really just don't want to cause harm to myself or others. And so I'm going to refrain from doing this action that does so. And likewise, refraining from stealing, lying or misusing speech, misusing sexuality, misusing intoxicants, all of these are places where grasping or constriction in the heart arises in my being, very often in the relational field. They're all kind of relational. And I do something that may cause harm. I use intoxicants in a way that causes me to act. The literal translation is with heedlessness, right? To act carelessly and cause harm. I use speech in a way that causes harm because why would I lie except out of fear, right? Or anger in some way, generally fear, right? Why would I, you know, act in a way that would hurt someone? Except that I was under the spell of grasping and delusion. So then this first stage, don't do that which causes harm, both protects those around you, protects yourself from doing actions, the results of which you will experience, and then begins to plant the seeds of this attitude that goes through the whole path, which is letting go. And that renunciation that starts in that first line, don't do that which causes harm, flips into the cultivating in the second line, do that which is skillful. The word skillful is kusala. And skillful and unskillful is another way of translating what I like to often translate as wholesome and unwholesome. In other words, there's not absolute good and evil in this system, right? partly because there's no external judge. There's no God who's judging you for your actions. There are gods in the Buddhist system, but they're not judging you, and they don't save you. They're actually just beings. You could have tea with them, and the Buddha does, but kind of cosmic tea. But he does. But they're not considered enlightened, right? They're extremely powerful, very long-lived, they're beautiful, they're fabulous, they come to visit him, but they're not enlightened. And so they don't save you, you save you. Or saving happens, and we'll get into the nature of the self at some point, not tonight. But because there's no deity to judge you, and judgment, in a way, is just a factor of your own delusion. Like, if you're judging yourself for being good or bad, that's just more grasping. I want to be like that awesome person. I want to be more like Lisa because she's awesome, but I suck. Like, that's not skillful, right? No matter how habitual it is, it's not wholesome. So the second line is not do good in a kind of way that we might recognize in a sort of, you know, Western good and evil context. It's really do what's skillful. And skillful means, and again, all of this is about karma, which is cause and effect. Skillful means that which brings about good results or useful results or healing or supportive or caretaking or brightening or liberating results. And so between those two first kind of pairs of cultivation, don't do that which causes harm, do that which is skillful, you get the stripping away and purification process that is really the bulk of the path. That's really the vast foundation. And so where in that first line, don't do that which causes harm, is the ethical practice. It's also the untrain the deep hindrances of like restlessness and boredom and anger and lust and fear and doubt from your being, the deep emotional contractions. See them, learn their antidotes, learn how to let those forces go as well, which really just means process them, forgive what needs to be forgiven, forget what needs to be forgotten, work with yourself, go to therapy, the whole deal, right? Whatever it takes. Don't do those things. And then the second line is cultivate that which helps. And there's these beautiful lists of what helps. One of the gorgeous lists of what helps. Maybe I'll do a bunch of talks on this at some point later. It's a list worth fleshing out. It's a list called the Seven Factors of Enlightenment or Awakening. Bojanga is the term in Pali. And it's a list that starts with mindfulness, basic paying attention, and then has three wholesome qualities or factors that are uplifting or brightening. A quality of curiosity or interest called investigation of dharmas, of dhamma. Investigating your process, investigating the world as it appears in your senses. And then the quality of energy itself, virya, that strong energy for practice. And then bliss or joy. The traditional translation is rapture. So you sit, you get concentrated, and the body and mind go, and it's so awesome to be breathing and embodied, and the mind gets really bright and rapture. And there's these beautiful descriptions of, you know, the state in the body that can happen when the mind gets quiet, the heart opens a little bit, breath gets soft, full in the body. So these three states, investigation, energy, and rapture, are considered wholesome. And it's important to notice that they are considered wholesome and skillful, and they are pleasurable. This isn't this is a pro-pleasure path, right? It's not pro-unskillful pleasure, right? Like pleasures that don't really get you further into wisdom and are kind of distracting, maybe not so useful. You might have a few of those in your life. But it's pro the pleasures of intimacy with ourselves. And the pleasures of meditation and yogic practice. So these three qualities uplift, and then three wholesome qualities that settle. The quality of tranquility itself, calming the body and mind, profound relaxation response quality, tranquility, pasadi. And concentration itself and equanimity. The meditative qualities of the mind getting settled and radiant, super still, and then the emotional quality of equanimity that receives experience in a balanced way. So this is a beautiful list of qualities to invoke. So this second line, do that which is skillful, you could think of as invoke these enlightenment factors or the 10 perfections we talked about last year. Generosity or giving, patience, faith, kindness, ethics, again, equanimity, wisdom. Cultivate the beautiful qualities. So these two go together. Strip away the things that are getting in your way and build up the things that support you. And then the third line of this verse, purify the mind. Points then directly to the yogic practice. And it's important to note that this third line is the one where the meditation practices live. The whole Buddhist path is not a meditation path. Gazillions of people practice with hardly ever meditating. Probably most monastics, monks and nuns, in Asia, for instance, millions of them, thousands at least, don't really meditate that much. It's not the core of the practice. In a way, ethics and renunciation and cultivating these emotional qualities of release is the core of the practice. Some people meditate very deeply, others not so much. In the West, Buddhism was brought here as a meditation path, and many people think that Buddhism equals meditation. But it's not the case. Meditation is a part of the whole thing. In Asia, probably if you asked, certainly in the early texts, when folks from other traditions were seeing the Buddhists and describing them, outsiders, people from Vedanta or other Hindu traditions, Chinese traditions, etc., very often what they said was, if they wanted to sort of dismiss the Buddhists, they were like, "Oh, Buddhism, that's the ethics path." In other words, it was the ethics piece that stood out as the central quality that the Buddha taught. And probably if you did some sort of data analysis of the texts, way more discussion about these qualities of the heart that are ethical and generous than meditation itself. But that said, it's still integral. It's not the whole thing, but it's integral. So this third part, purify the mind, speaks to something that I think can only happen once some amount of that initial decreasing of the hindrances and the constrictions of the heart and bringing up of the beautiful qualities has happened. Until those things happen, I think meditation is difficult, for one thing, but at the very least, it's a kind of self-therapy. In other words, while the mind is still a mess, if when you sit down, you're kind of immediately assaulted by waves of emotion and thoughts and stories all the time, and you're sorting out your relationships, and you're figuring out what to do next and how to avoid the nasty stuff, and you're just kind of working your psyche, sitting in meditation can be a wonderful place to do that. Because how often do you actually take a chunk of time to just sit down and be with yourself and confront all that stuff? But in a classical sense, all of that is more properly the realm of those earlier stages, where you're actually kind of processing feeling and engaging with your process. Mostly I'll say like, in relationship or out and about in your life. So if I'm having a challenging time with my sweetheart, I can process some of it sitting in meditation, but actually most of it is going to get processed actually in interaction, in speaking, in being together, in work, in living together and working out our constrictions together. In other words, relational disturbance is very often based in an ethical or emotional conflict rather than in the specific purity of the mind. And the meditation practice is oriented toward the purification of the mind. This is partly why I very often suggest to folks that sitting meditation is not their only practice. And for some people, I suggest that they don't even sit in meditation. If the psyche, especially this is in cases of kind of fairly severe trauma, sitting meditation can be quite the wrong thing to do. You know, I've had folks come to me and say, like, you know, I'm super anxious, I'm really a wreck, I'm kind of falling apart. You know, can you tell me about meditation? I need to find settledness. And I'm like, I think you should hang out with your friends. First of all, do you have friends? And then, like, where do you hang out with them? How about get together with a friend you trust and walk in nature? Like, don't like sit still and lock the body up and close your eyes and kind of dive into the deep well of distress. That's not appropriate. Right? Do what is skillful. In other words, back up a step. Do what's skillful. And so the meditation practices are the practices oriented toward purifying the mind. And the mind purifies when there is a strong foundation of both ethics and intention and some of these good qualities. There's patience, there's energy, right? There's some equanimity to be able to sit with the swirling mind and not get thrown off base. You have to be able to do that for the meditation to work, essentially. Right? If you get completely thrown off, it's actually better to do something that doesn't throw you off. Right? And again, there's lots of other things to do. Go dancing, you know. Walk in the woods. Take care, like, get more exercise and eat well. And then what I mostly nowadays, and I'm growing in this, so I say it more and more often. 10 years ago, I wasn't saying it. I was still, like, really, 10 years ago. I started sitting in 1993 in this Zen center that was all discipline all the time. It was just, like, bolt upright, lift the sternum. If you fall asleep, they hit you with a stick. Really just, like, And we would say things like, you know, meditation is like having your nose up against a brick wall, and you don't move until either you break or the wall breaks, right? And it's, you know, it's fine. I was 22. I'm like, the wall will break. The wall didn't break. I didn't do so well there. I broke a little bit. So I found softer practices, softer and softer and softer and softer. And now, as far as I can tell, purification of the mind and the depths of meditation practice happen best for those who find the practice actually pleasurable. It's actually sweet to sit with yourself. Doesn't mean it's always easy, doesn't mean it's calm, but it means that in some way you can do it. You like it. You want it. You have a kind of passion for finding yourself. And so sometimes it's hard to sit, of course, and sometimes it's super easy, but there is a quality of center that I think though makes the whole meditation part easier, more pleasurable, and more effective. So purify the mind really speaks to the part of practice where we are learning how to not be distracted, basically. How to clarify our relationship with all those things that pull the mind away. Fantasy and fear. What I call kind of the four directions of kind of past and future. Or pleasant and unpleasant thought in relation to the past, pleasant and unpleasant in relation to the future. So all of those are the sort of, they're the realms of distraction, right? In relation to the past and the negative, I have regret, right? or I'm just churning somehow with what happened. Trauma process is also there. The past that was positive, I have nostalgia, right? Oh, that trip, it was so good. I'm just going to think about it again. That mimosa I had on the beach with that person, oh my God, I like them, oh my God. Maybe I'll see them again. And then I jump into the future, right? So the two future categories, pleasant future is hope, and painful future is fear. So here's a proposal for like actually landing in the present moment, would be to have the intention to no longer indulge those four channels. So regret, let it go. I'm just going to say this as if it's easy. It's totally not easy. But we're going to pretend it's easy for a moment. The negative past, it happened, it's done, let it go. What that really means is you might have to do trauma therapy for a long time, and that's fine. But that's the process for doing that, right? But the intention is to let the past settle, to be done. The positive past, the nostalgic past, let it go. It's gone. Sorry, right? And it will never return. That one takes a different kind of process, right? That one often takes a kind of, I don't even have a good method for that one, really. It's kind of just like, that is gone, right? It's like, even if you didn't get what you wanted, the party's over. And there might be another one next week, but it's not happening now. And you just like, you walk out into the clear light of Monday morning, and you're like, I got this, I had this amazing time, or I didn't get what I want. And either way, you're like, it's now. You know. So that's that practice. The future practice, abandoning fear, we all want to do it, very, very difficult. Come out, just don't indulge anxiety. I have a friend who's working with a teacher right now who says, you're gonna go on an anxiety diet. And what you're gonna do is you're gonna decide how many minutes each day you're gonna allow for anxious thought. And past that, you just don't allow it. And so you're like, if 10 minutes a day is your, and I'm like, that's pretty strict, 10 minutes a day, man. I'm gonna be like, come on, I need a little more. But, you know, how do you stop fearing the future? And so there's a lot in there about, you know, the feelings of safety. Again, trauma is in play here. You wouldn't fear the future if you didn't have some experience that had led you to fear the future. So again, that's a therapeutic process. And the one that nobody really wants to let go of is hope. So at the beginning of a new year, just for fun, I'll say the thing that you know, no one wants to pay me to say, which is stop hoping for the future. Meaning, not meaning like stop doing actions in order to improve things, meaning stop spinning in the fantasy of a better future as a thought process, right? Come back into the present and then do your work. You know what you want the future to be. You want it to be better. That's great. I'm looking forward to an election myself. But to churn it through the mind, you know, I want, doesn't actually bear fruit. So again, you could give yourself a hope quotient each, or you know, a hope diet each day. And that can be a beautiful kind of intention setting. You can just be like, you know, I want to be productive today, kind to my family, and I really want to work toward a better administration in the future, whatever it is. And then, like, that's it. You did it. You hoped. Stop. Right? And just get on with your work. So purify the mind really means, like, get a handle on all that stuff the mind does that pulls you away from yourself, pulls you away from centeredness. And learn to do otherwise. Learn to concentrate, learn to settle, learn to open without getting lost. Come out of the old metaphor would be dream, really. And another way of saying purify the mind is get into the body, because it's the same thing, right? Coming out of those realms of fantasy and fear and being lost also means coming into the present, and all the present means is the body, right? Present just means I'm awake to the sensations and the experience that's coming in through my sensory embodied existence right now. So there's sights and sounds and smells and tastes and physical contact. And there's emotions and thoughts, but the thing that we want to tune into is their physical or energetic manifestation. Right? So all of that suggests that purify the mind really means understand it, grapple with it, ultimately I don't want to say be in control of it, but have a more engaged relationship with it than we often do. One of the things the Buddha says, it's a strange thing to say, he says when you've purified the mind, the one who's purified the mind thinks the thoughts they want to think and doesn't think the thoughts they don't want to think. And that's really interesting. Like, we so often, the mind kind of does its own thing. We think of it as like the thing that just does its thing, and I have very little control over it. One of the earliest metaphors for working with the mind is that the process of the mind and the senses and the kind of the witness or the sense of self is like a horse and a chariot and a driver, and that the horse is going to get pulled off the path by the objects of the senses, sights and sounds and smells and tastes and physical contacts, and it's the job of the charioteer to guide the horse well. And it's a good metaphor. Like, we put blinders on horses for a reason, right? They get distracted. And so what would it mean for you to actually steer the horse that is your own body-mind rather than just kind of go wherever it chooses to go, off the road, into the ditch, over the fence, to some flowers, to a pretty horse that's over there in the pasture. You're just like, pulling the reins. So, purify the mind. And that's it. That's the whole thing, according to this verse. So the way the path goes essentially is grapple with your big constrictions until there's a bit of basic clarity. That basic clarity becomes the foundation for bringing up all the wholesome qualities and working to invoke these beautiful aspects that are possible as beings. And then with that as a foundation, then the subtle energetic practice of coming profoundly into the body and out of the realms of fantasy and fear. The last line says that is the teaching of the Buddhas. And the word Buddha means awake. So that is the teaching of, or the path of awakening. And awakening really is mysterious, and I won't say more about it tonight other than what it feels like and looks like and seems like is it's the natural result of those things happening. It's not a special other thing as much as once that process starts to mature, a kind of clarity starts to grow in those folks who have cultivated those qualities. And that clarity becomes very strong and transforms everything about their life. So, don't do that which causes harm. Do that which is skillful. Purify the mind. That's the teaching of the Buddhas. So, take some time to hear your thoughts and reflections, questions, or anything about your own practice you'd like to share.
I was wondering, you said that so many of the nuns and monks in Asia, they're doing a practice that's more, you said something to do with, I don't know, like the emotions, it's not the meditation so much. But something about the way you said it made me wonder more about what you meant in terms of what they're doing.
What are they doing, all those folks who don't meditate? When I went to become a monk in Burma, I had the idea that everybody was on full-time retreat, basically, just meditating all day. And then, you know, and then a few folks were actually on retreat, as I was, and doing that. But then there was, like, everybody else. Like, what are they doing? And here's a different way of saying it. They are living communally. So somebody's cleaning up something, somebody is doing a bunch of sewing, somebody is writing, somebody is organizing the books, somebody's, you know, arranging a festival for next week, somebody is talking to caterers, somebody is in the library doing something, somebody is making food for the teacher, like...
So they're living in community, and so they're living out the ethics and precepts,
yeah,
relationally,
yeah,
by living together.
Yes. Okay. The path, as the Buddha described it, he called it, when someone would come to ordain, he said, you know, someone would say, I want to lead the holy life in this Dhamma and discipline. And so the term is Dhamma Vinaya. Vinaya means the discipline, the monastic discipline. And so for the men, for the monks, it was 227 rules. It's a set of rules called the Patimokkha. And we would chant it every 2 weeks together. And what it is this whole set of guidelines for essentially how to live very harmoniously together, you know, and their rules, you know, their practices, really. Like, lots of them were not that necessary for me. You know, they were things like if the lay people really like you and they give you a dozen robes, only keep three, you know, like give the rest away. They were things that were really irrelevant to me, like when you're plastering your hut, don't plaster over the plants. And I'm like, it's a fine, sensible rule, like don't drip house plaster on the plants. But I wasn't plastering a hut, so it didn't matter, but it was in there. The rule that I actually had to practice with the most, I'll tell you what it was. It was a rule that said, don't look into another monk's begging bowl with the intent to criticize, right? So don't like look and be like, oh, you got some really nice food, you jerk. I didn't get that.
Oh, so like or, the grocery store and the checkout line, right?
one could like just renounce looking in someone else's cart and being like, Fruit Loops, huh? You know, just don't do it. Just, you know, and so like that would be the discipline. And so a lot of what the monks and nuns are doing is they're living a whole life that's embedded in this discipline. And then some of them are doing intensive meditation, some of them are doing a tiny bit, some of them are doing a lot. Mm. You know, you can do the whole path just praying, just being in devotion, you know. So that's...
Yeah, that clarifies.
Yeah. And meditation particularly, it seems like in the South... In the Southeast Asian traditions anyway, which are my lineage now, both in Thailand and Burma and Sri Lanka, the meditation practices themselves were actually substantially reinvented in the early 20th century. In other words, there was a whole range of centuries there where they were very not central, and then they were reinvented in the late 19th and early 20th century, in many cases as a response to colonialism. So, and that's another, that's a story. But, yeah. Other thoughts here?
I'm wondering how the philosophy that you've discussed, just basically live in the present, how you can orient that in this goal-oriented society we're living in, where you're oftentimes the not only
Yeah.
And think about what you want for the future and then kind of lay the works in between.
Yeah.
Can the two go together or?
I hope so, because I'm here. You know, can setting goals, you know, in the kind of conventional societal way right now kind of fold well into this? There's probably a couple layers of answer depending on what you want out of your spiritual practice, I would guess. So, like, if what you're going for is profound liberation from suffering, then at the very least, adding a layer of self-reflection to that goal process, for instance, like, okay, what's my goal? It's like, well, I want to buy a house within 10 years, let's say. And I'll just say that I would love to, right? I've been kind of poor my whole adult life, and everything's expensive here, but gosh, wouldn't it feel secure to have that? But what I do in relation to that is I do want that, but I also do a layer of inquiry around it where I might ask myself, why do I want that? And which is what our society doesn't do much, right? They're just like, yeah, well, having wants is divine because we're a consumer society. So you want it, you just want it. Like, no one's going to say, like, yeah, well, what do you want that for? But in this practice, we'd be like, well, what do you want that for? And if I really feel into it, I'm like, I just want to feel a certain kind of rooted security that I'm on a spot on the earth that no one can kick me off of, something like that. I want to feel secure. And then if I actually just am intelligent, I will realize that even if I had a house and I owned it, and I know people with houses, and it's hard, right? There's a lot to do. It's not necessarily that. But I would even more deeply know that that itself is always going to be an illusion, right? There's just not that. You can't own something and never lose it. The recognition that nothing can be held onto is core here. So one reflection would be, I have this goal, but I'm not going to believe it, that it's this kind of ultimate thing. You know, I have a goal in this society because I want to take care of my family, so I have the goal out of the generosity that I feel in wanting to support them. But I don't want to lose myself in the idea that that goal is the most important thing, or even that that goal is going to make me happy. And that's the thing to always reflect on is, will this make me happy? And the answer basically always has to be either no, but it'll do something else, which is fine, or maybe, but only for a little while. But if the answer is yes, this will make me happy, then look more deeply, because it can't ever be true, right? Because happy is a state based in conditions, and conditions always change. So, you know. So mostly in relation to, like, goals in this culture, like in Bay Area culture nowadays, mostly I think not even about, like, folks around me, like, getting what they really want. Mostly folks around me are just trying to survive. And so goals even seems like a privileged way to say, oh, I have the luxury to kind of want something extra, you know. Is it a goal to be like, I just want to make my rent and not get evicted? Like, it's sort of a goal, but it's actually kind of just, like, basic taking care of life, you know. And even if I was a monk, I would have a goal to like, not let my lineage die out, or keep the patrons happy so that the monastery will be paid for, because somebody's got to pay for it. So there's always action oriented toward useful or skillful results. The thing that I think the goal kind of stuff that you're pointing to, the place where that differs is maybe in how deeply you or one might believe that the attainment of the goal is a kind of final arrival. And as long as we know that it's not, I think they're not incompatible, right? One is a kind of deep spiritual truth, and the other is, you know, a very kind of conventional one. But you find this in lots of religions. There are folks on some of the more extreme ends of Christianity who, you know, who don't believe in having goals on earth either, because what you believe that something on earth is you should orient your attention toward rather than just life in the kingdom of heaven. So there's folks who are very much renouncing, even in a lay context, engagement on the earth because heaven is the only thing. And so the parallel here really is that, like, if you're going for liberation, earthly goals are incidental. But they have a place in conventional reality, especially if you're taking care of others. You know, if you're taking care of a family, it's appropriate. And that points, again, maybe a little bit, just to finish up, at why the monastic practice was so central, you know, in the early years of this, in the early many centuries of this practice, was that it was actually recognized that taking care of a family and having a business and raising children was incompatible with letting go all the way, in the way that this doctrine pointed toward. So you could do a lot of this practice as a layperson, and then once you got to that profound letting go of everything, past and future, you kind of have to become a monastic, because it's the only way to have no responsibilities, essentially. So if you want to know where to go to be a nun or a monk, well cared for, let me know. There's good places. Never touch money again. What do you think that would be like?
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Even not holding money or a credit card in my hand for several months as a monk, when I first did it again, when I had to unmonk and come back to the States, my mom was dying. I was in the Bangkok airport and I was buying some food, and I just looked at the money in my hand and it just felt like, oh, I haven't touched money in like months. And it was just like, oh, I kind of get it. Like, that was nice to just not go there, right? I was also standing in the Bangkok airport, holding the money, looking at the snacks, wondering what I want, and then, like, you know, some pretty people walked by, and I'm like, ooh, you're cute. And I was like, wait, you know. I've been out of my monk's robe for 12 hours, and I'm suddenly, you know, just as... Any other thoughts?
You mentioned earlier when you were talking about the kind of trying to live in the present and having fear and nostalgia in the past, regret and nostalgia in the past and fear and hope in the future, and that you weren't sure how to deal with the nostalgia part. And I was thinking about it, and I think something that kind of helps me is, not that I necessarily think that, I enjoy nostalgia to some extent.
Yeah.
I think most people do, I guess.
Yeah.
But kind of cultivating appreciation for who you are and remembering that that comes from things that have happened and that are done. Kind of makes it maybe a little bit easier to not have it anymore. It's, you still kind of do have it. If you think that you are a product of everything that's come before you.
No, I like it, you know. Right, how to process nostalgia. The appreciation piece is beautiful, for sure. And it's almost like if I have to process past wounding that we call trauma or whatever in order to essentially have it not be arising in the present as symptoms, what if I have to do the same thing for past pleasures? Right? I have to process them emotionally so they're not arising in the present as symptoms. And the symptoms would be things like longing, you know, or wishing, or just kind of like, you know. And so what if actually, I talk about this sometimes when I say that there's a spectrum of influences from the past that I call the trauma privilege spectrum, which is basically like, if really good things happened to you and you're having the symptoms of those now, that's privilege. And if really bad things happened to you and you're having the symptoms of them now, that's trauma. And we all have some mix, of course. But in both cases, to arrive fully now, you have to process what happened in some ways, or digest it or integrate it into your being in order for the symptoms to subside. And so what you're saying, like, yeah, appreciating how it is part of how you became who you are, I think that's true in an interesting way for both the painful and the pleasurable past, right? I wonder if you could use the same methods you use to process past trauma to process privilege as well, right? To really feel in the present how this past situation is present and affecting your life right now, you know? And I think that the current kind of wave of sort of socio-political recognition of the harmfulness of privilege might be a way of saying that the present time symptoms of privilege are problematic in the same way that the present time symptoms of trauma are problematic. And so then, how do you process that and then come into, you know, a more grounded present?
So the symptoms are like longing?
Well, I mean, yeah, you know, let's say, you know, so let me pick a pleasant past. I was privileged enough to go to an expensive and really fringe kind of radical art school for music. So I did privileged radical art things, right, at the age of 20. And it was interesting and fun. The people were wild and weird and sexy and fun and strange and you know, and it was great and stupid and all sorts of things all at once. But what remained for some years afterward, and it's mostly gone now, really, but for some years afterward, there was something like, it's almost like the feeling of being at the art school, at the conservatory, gave me a sense of like a certain kind of intellectual and aesthetic specialness. I was one of the awesome ones, right? And everyone else was a kind of, you know, faceless corporate sheep, but we were the radical artists. And so I had a kind of like, it was pleasurable, but the result of it was this kind of egotistical jerkiness. But it came with a kind of wanting to stay in that state. So to keep hanging out with cool artists and to make really cool art and make edgier art and get more deep in my art and become known and get a name and all these things that were ambitious and had grasping to them. Grasping at something that was present in the past, a state that was true in the past and is no longer true, is one of the primary current symptoms then of past, you know, pleasurable things. It's like I still want it to be happening. But it turned out that it was not happening. And, you know, I was not a radical, you know, boundary-breaking artist. I worked at a restaurant in San Francisco, like all the other boundary-breaking artists. And, you know, the bartender who was my friend turned out to be one of the most subtle, brilliant filmmakers of his experimental generation. And, you know, and now he raises goats out in Bolinas and has a kid. No money at all. So, like, here we are. We did our thing. But that would be, like, the present symptom of that thing. And so you have to get over that. Be like, get over yourself, dude. And then once that getting over oneself happened, like trauma, the result of resolving past karma is that the symptom is gone. So that grasping disappears, the longing disappears, the anxiety or vigilance that is the result of trauma fades. I can still remember it. I still remember like all the naked people at the pool and like the like some really odd performances that I saw and some really inspiring ones and all that stuff. But it doesn't like grab my heart. I don't want to be back there doing that again. So, yeah, I healed from art school. It took a while. All right, so let's finish the evening. in the way that I want to experiment with doing. On the back of the chant sheet, at the bottom is these verses called the Dedication and Sharing of Merit. And these are beautiful. They take a little bit to learn the Pali, so we'll just do them and learn them at the end of our evenings. And then after we close, there's the box over there for generosity. We're on the gift economy here. Your offerings of your resources help the group to remain open to all and a tiny bit free of the kind of consumer mindset as best we can. Thank you for your generosity there. You can also give at the front desk in any other format. So this is a sharing of merit and a dedication of our practice. I'll sing the Pali and then speak the English. Sambe sata sada hontu avera sukha jivino kattam punya phalam mayam sabe bhagi bhavantute hotu sabang sumangalam rakantu sabha devata sabha buddhanubhavena soti hontu nirantaram hotu sabang sumangalam rakantu sabha devata sabha dhammanubhavena soti hontu nirantaram hotu sabang sumangalam rakantu sabha devata sabha sanghanubhavena soti hontu nirantaram. May all beings be happy, free from animosity. Whatever merit is the fruit of this practice, may it be shared by all beings. May there be every good blessing. May the devas protect you. By the power of the Buddha, may you forever be well. May there be every good blessing. May the devas protect you. By the power of the Dhamma, may you forever be well. May there be every good blessing. May the devas protect you. By the power of the Sangha, may you forever be well.